Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towns of Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive. We are positively here. One of my favorite places, celebrating 40 years of Coco's Pub. We're here in Lauraville having a good time. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. I have the Lucky 7. I'm in a cuckoo mood because it's my 27th anniversary. I am still hungover, and I didn't even drink anything here on Sunday, with the crab cakes, the corn, the chowder, all the delicious things we had here as we celebrated 40 years. I'm sure Marcella will have a burger on special here for me. I'm probably going to leave with some ribs today. I've already had some cream of crab soup. But before it's over, we will celebrate number 5 on the 27-day countdown brought to you by Curio Wellness and our friends at GBMC. It will be not the coconut shrimp, but the coconut shrimp. I actually saw that delicious snozberry sauce getting poured out over here. I said, is that for me? It was like tons of it. But we're at Coco's. We're in Lauraville. And I have a first-time visitor on that I'm sure is very nervous on the program right now. He is the returning Baltimore City Councilman from the District 3, which is right here. I call it Resig's District is what I call it. Resig's going to be here a little later on. Ryan Dorsey is here. Virgin Flight. Man, I've been inviting you on for years. Where have you been hiding, man? Everybody knows you but me.
I've been dodging you.
I think you have been. I think you have. How are you? Good to know you, meet you. I met you on Sunday here. Sunday was something, right? I mean, you represent this council. People say, Baltimore City, no good business. Here's Coco celebrating 40 years right up the street from your childhood home where you're a sitting councilman. You visit with your wife. You come in. And what I saw on here Sunday was 40 years
worth
of community, love, all the things that would make anybody from Baltimore City proud. Right?
Nobody's got a problem coming around when crab cakes are on the menu.
Well, right. Well, you got invited, and you know where the best ones are in your council or your district, right? Councilmanic district.
Anywhere, not just my district, mm-hmm. My city, my state, anywhere. I never had anybody ever had a better crab cake than Coco.
Well, I tell you what, I do the crab cake tour. So I was at Costas the other day. Last week I was at Fadley's. I get around to all the places, and people, when I say Coco's, they're like, hey, got to get over there.
Fadley's.
Everybody knows what's up, and we are a crab cake city, and everybody knows this is an epicenter, a complete destination. I don't want to be unkind to Coco's or Ruth's Chris, but I'd say it's sort of the Ruth's Chris of your council. It's just a gathering point for everyone. I know you're proud of your district. I never had you on. I know you grew up here. Resig has been telling me about you for years. You grew up with Resig's kids, who, by the way, named me Nasty Nestor.
Okay.
Steve and Ryan are the reason, your namesake and your classmate.
Nobody calls him Ryan.
They, Tup, named me. We think it was Tup. Steve took a little bit of a credit for it the other day. But I was nicknamed Nasty Nestor right here on Eastdale Drive, babysitting those kids in 1989. And said Uncle Nestor, they called me Nasty Nestor. And that's the reason. And you are the direct link to the descendants of Nasty Nestor. How about that?
I dig it.
Well, you grew up here. So I say, why did you run? Not everybody runs for council. Not everybody's as feisty as you've been on lots of issues. I'm going to let you standing tall on all the bicycle, all the things that you're Montebello and what happened here in the bridge and all that. You're proud of this district, but you grew up here. You never left. Why?
Because it's a great place to live. My family's here. I'm from here. I'm rooted here. I like it here. I worked in a family business for years after college. I went to school for music. The return on investment as a, the prospects of becoming a rock star are pretty slim,
right? You're a guitar guy? What are you?
No, I actually started college as a violin major, and then my degree is in music composition. Not a whole lot of job prospect there. And also, all that stuff takes, grueling hours and hours and hours, thousands of hours, sitting alone in a practice room. And that's just not me. That's not who I am. That's not what I want to do. That's not what I want to spend my time. I want to spend my time chopping it up, right?
Right.
And
but you still play the violin?
No, I don't. Not for a long time.
Oh, okay.
I worked in a family business, basically hanging TVs on rich people's walls for years.
What was the business?
Soundscape over on Cold Spring Lane, Roland Park. And the value kind of return on that isn't necessarily what I think I was looking for in life, and was just kind of like, you know, what could I do? I'm still young.
Make an impact. Make a mark.
Yeah. Okay. And if I say Baltimore sucks and I love it, you know exactly what I mean. And so does everybody else that I know. Baltimore has been, for a long time, kind of a hard place to live for a lot of people, especially if you really care about it and want to make people's lives better. And or even just realize that we have greater potential than we realize as a city, as a community, as a population. And the activism here wears people down, and they go into some other like world, or they just, you know, lay back from it after a while because they tired of banging their heads up against the wall. Everybody I know, when I say Baltimore sucks and I love it, it's not but I love it, it's and I love it, because I do love it here, and it is difficult to live here. And you know, I have plenty of friends who would do a good job at, I think, the role of like public servant, but are also doing other things. Like, they're musicians, they're nurses, they're lawyers, they're just parents, they're whatever. They work at a restaurant, right? Plenty of people doing the thing that like suits them, and no need for them to uproot in order to take a position of public service and leadership if they don't want to. But I think that they'd be great at it. I want those people to stay where they are, doing what it is that they're really good at and they love. And I just got to a point in my life where I was like, what can I do? What should I do? And this was a thing that kind of just in a conversation here and there came up as a thing that might be an opportunity. And I didn't really know anything about public service, you know, electoral politics, campaigns, elections.
You weren't a Schoolhouse Rock social studies kid like Johnny O, like on that path. Hey, Carson Kamenetz on this week.
None of that.
His father ran. He grew up in a household. When did this strike you on a day to say, I can run for councilman? You know, it's the first step to being whatever you want to be in the political space. But like, especially in your own, did you even know where your district was?
I didn't know the first thing.
Were you
about
a voter?
Anything.
You haven't done anything. Okay.
Yeah, I had literally never voted in a local primary election when I decided I was going to run.
You only voted
for
president or like
yeah,
that,
general
yeah.
elections, president, governor, whatever, even local general elections. But I had never voted in a local primary election, and that's what matters the most. In Baltimore City, determining who the Democratic nominee is going to be, because we haven't elected a non-Democrat in six decades. And I had never realized the importance of that, didn't know who my representatives
were. Even as a city resident who had watched mayors go to jail, mayors go to governorship, The Wire, all of that, you were not politically, were your parents politically active?
Sure, my parents, and in fact, I had... in my band that I was playing in after college, one of my bandmates was a political organizer, actually. And I didn't really think much about what that meant or what he did on a day-to-day basis.
What era was this we talking about? Turn of
the
century?
We played a Sheila Dixon event in Patterson Park when she was the sitting city council president and was running for...
So this is when O'Malley was the mayor.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you're talking turn of the century, talk 25 years ago, right?
And I even played an event. Was it maybe when she was actually mayor running for mayor?
All of this had happened. What turned your eye to the community? I can tell you what it did for me. I lived in the city 20 years down in Harvard. I'm a wacky-ass sports radio guy, right? That's what I do, right? My wife got cancer in 14 and 15, and I was over at Hopkins. She's fighting for her life, leukemia. We're a mile and a half away from Hopkins. And I saw all that happened with Kathy, with Sheila with the gift cards, with Trump getting elected, with Freddie Gray. I saw the fireball in the sky over here in East Baltimore because I lived on the 23rd floor. I had video of the fireballs on the night of Freddie Gray. And that put me into a space to say, I'm going to run for mayor. So I put this together in 17, 18, and 19 to run in 20 because I thought Sheila was just going to win. I thought Sheila was going to win the primary and I was going to get in as independent and duke it out in the summer of 2020. Then we all had masks on.
Yeah.
The election got moved 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Brandon went from a young man who came and sat with me at Fadley's telling me his Mervo Subway story. And when he got mugged with Don Moeller, and Don Moeller says, nice kid, too bad he can't win. about right. Brandon, right?
Right. Because
he was Jack Young was the mayor at that point. And I'm like, I live in this city. Somebody, Ryan, me, you, Bill, TJ, Mary Mill, I don't care who it is. Somebody's got to step up and be on the up and up about the city. And Ted Venatoulis always said to me, you'll do more not ever running with this. So you talk about what you could do to be a public servant. I think I decided that the best thing I could do was talk to guys like you and women like, you know, Brooke, and hold you all accountable after being elected, because I'm unelectable. I moved to the county a couple years ago, but not for any political reasons, just I sold my place. But, like, I get where you're coming from to say, I never thought about running for office. I thought about running for Nasty Nestor in sports, but, like, city's effed up. And it has bones, it has great people, it has all this, all the things we all love about it. But to your point, it still needs caring, responsible people to try to lift it every day, you know? And I'm glad all of you step up. I like all of you. I like Felicia, I like you. I met Mark last week. I mean, everybody on the council, Bill Henry's coming over. I know all of you to be people that really, Corey, I mean, people that I have on the show all the time. There's a lot of really good public servants. Now, maybe you feel the same way being involved in it.
I do. But, you know, at the same time, look, there wasn't some, like, catalyst event that pushed me into it. It was just this general, like, years and years of living here and everybody feeling like the city could be better, and that the fact that it's not, just generally, must have something to do with the people in leadership, and so why don't we change that leadership? And so, you know, I essentially explored the idea and just went, oh, that guy's my city council representative? I met him once. I bet I could do the job better than him. That's about it. And then just put myself to it. It was about a year and a half out from the next primary election. I figured.
What year was this?
That was the fall of 2014.
14, okay.
Yeah, so it was. I was about a year and a half out.
Before Freddie Gray?
I was about a year and a half out from the 2016
Kathy Pugh
primary.
Had not been healthy hollied yet?
She and I were elected at the same time.
Okay.
I announced my candidacy at Clementine up in Hamilton.
Sheila had already been caught with the cards at that point.
Of
that, right?
The Baltimore uprising.
Oh, wow. Okay, so.
I was literally like.
15.
Yeah, people were like.
May of 15. Yeah.
What is going on in the city right now? And everybody was basically saying, you know, I don't know that I can do anything about what is happening right here, right now, this moment, tonight. But I know that there's a future where we need change. And Ryan is proposing to be a part of that change. And I'm going to support him in that. And the Resigs were there, you know. And
you just literally, you knocked doors, walked the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're not like a super famous dude that ran for student council who knew everybody and shook every hand or worked at the bar here. You know, like, you told me you worked at Bo Brooks at one point.
I did.
Up the street. But, I mean, did you have any business, human, I don't even mean money. I just mean, like, was there the first 50 people or 100 people that told you this was a good idea? Or were there people saying, oh, come on, dude. You know, I mean, I'm sure you're young, right? You're young, white, no political background. You're all that. Getting taken seriously out of the gate probably was your first challenge, right? Like, literally, right?
As the idea occurred to me and I started thinking about it and started having some, like, conversation about it, you know, I was up kind of on Facebook Messenger sending messages to people.
Did they think you were beer talking, or are you a serious
enough
guy?
I haven't had a drink in 22
years.
No,
I'm just saying, like, did they think you're poop talking, or, like, you're really going to do it? Once they get an email from you, they know you're serious.
One of the first people that I went to was the mother of a longtime friend and family I'm friends with, and her reaction was, oh, my goodness, this is such a great idea. You'll do great. I'm sure that you can do this. And one of the next people that I contacted was her ex-husband, who I'm also just as close with. And his response was, you can't be serious. But if you are, you should talk to so-and-so and so-and-so.
Most importantly, could she vote for you and could he not? Or could
In fact, she could and he could not. Yeah.
Well, so Ryan Dorsey's here.
Let me tell you, when I realized what I needed to do, in order to actually be able to run
file legally, do all that.
I knew I needed a campaign treasurer, that was an essential.
Well, it was always on the bumper sticker, so I always knew that was the
friends
important.
Friends of, right? Yeah,
treasurer?
You have to have a treasurer legally, and they're on the hook. If something funny happens with the money, they are criminally on the hook. So you got to be really close with your person. And I went to a person who I kind of hardly knew, but who was kind of a friend of a friend and was kind of an anarchist punk, queer, and was in school to become an accountant. And I was like, hey, I know it won't win you any cool points to be the treasurer on a Democratic campaign, but maybe it'll look good on a resume. I don't know. Would you be interested in doing this? And the response was also, you can't be serious.
And but the other part is, if they're not taking you seriously, they're thinking, well, I won't have a whole lot of money to worry about.
My response was, stupider people have done it.
Oh, yeah, well, that's true.
And so the reaction was, fair point. Okay.
I was almost one.
Let's do it. And so we did it. And that friend is still my campaign treasurer today.
All right. Well, so you're two in, going third, right?
Third. I'm in my third term right now.
Third term. Okay.
Yeah. And it's great. It's the best one yet.
Let's do the postcard for the city. If Brandon's sitting here, which he loves the crab cake at Coco's, by the way, and he has sat here with masks on in the middle of the plague when he first got elected and all that stuff. For you, with the state of the city, for people out there, black, white, young, old, I hate the city, I'm never coming downtown, to people that came twice for Nate Bargatze last week or coming down to the Ravens game week after next, state of the city as you see it, things that your eyes saw in 14 or 15 as a neophyte, I don't know what the hell I'm doing guy, you've picked fights with lots of different people and gotten you have things you can say you've created and stood on and things. What has helped the city and this renaissance part sell me now as a county resident? I'm in the city 4 days a week. I mean, I see it myself. I drive through the city and see less crime, less trash, less mess, less dirt, less threat. Just driving through, I don't feel like bad things are going to happen because the place feels much more cleaned up, despite what the douchebag in the White House has to say about it. But nonetheless.
We are improved over the last 4 or 5 years, especially in terms of the state of our public infrastructure and investments, our buildings, our parks, our rec centers, or whatever. We are improved in the state of our agency operations and improving. And some of that stuff takes a long time to like right this ship when you've got decades of like kind of poor
direction.
Explain
what that means. Public works, picking up the trash, all basic services.
Yeah, and even administratively having SOPs in basic city agency operations.
Right.
Making sure that
I need to get a permit. Oh, man, that was always the biggest nightmare for city business owners, to say they need to get a permit.
For the city agency personnel to have a specific way of doing their job in a reliable and consistent manner that can deliver services to the average person consistently. We're better and improving in that. And we have been, in recent years, and I've been a part of this, I think, passing laws that set us on a long-term trajectory of improvement. Create a complete streets law that says that our streets need to not only accommodate the highest volume and highest speeds of car travel, but to meet all people's needs in terms of how they safely and effectively get from point A to point B, whether or not they own a car. We have an inspector general's office that is this independent watchdog that I also led on that.
Big deal in the county, by the way.
Big deal in the county, big deal in the city. We have improved ethics laws to hold people like myself, but other city employees and contractors accountable as well.
Give me an example of that. I mean, because I have no pushback on this. I'm just trying to understand what you say. Listen, ethics when, in the city, I almost ran for mayor, crazy as me, because I was just tired of being lied to, ripped off, stolen from as a resident, right? Like, that was going to be the baseline of I'm like you. I might not have known what I was doing, but I'd be honest doing it. You know, he's coming into it. And I never felt that way, right? And people outside feel like, if you want to be a criminal, get into city government. And I've never felt that way at all. But putting more ties in so that the Healthy Hollies and I'm going to steal gift cards or whatever it's going to be isn't going to happen anymore. Having that trust is, man, that's the most, I think that was one of the things that was really missing. Probably one of the things that got you into government.
So I did two things simultaneously. Look, there are kind of like four pillars to like what I do as kind of a leader. I care about housing, jobs, and transportation. Where we live, where we work, and how we get between the two. These are the three kind of three legs of livability, right? They work together. They're symbiotic. And then there's this fourth thing of like government accountability and trust that's kind of separate from that.
And without that, you got nothing. Like literally.
You don't have a government that can effectively deliver any of the other stuff.
Sure.
And so I created the Inspector General's office in my first term. And then also what happened in the first term, look, I had no love for Kevin Davis as a police commissioner and was happy to see him go. But then when Catherine Pugh was nominating a new police commissioner nominee, she put forth Daryl D'Souza, who wouldn't answer critical questions about like basic philosophy on public safety and policing, things either in private or in the public confirmation hearings. He just wouldn't answer these questions that I thought were really important. And so I voted against him and specifically said, how could I possibly vote for a person who won't even answer these basic questions for me? And then 2 months later, he was being federally indicted for fraud and going to federal prison. And the day after the indictment came down, it came out that, you know, maybe 2 days later, that he also hadn't been filing his financial disclosure forms with the city properly annually. He had been here for a long time. He wasn't filing these forms. And then the day after that, it came out that none of the top brass at BPD was filing their financial disclosure forms. And so I rewrote the whole system of how we ensure that we as a city know who is supposed to file these forms, that those people unequivocally know that they are required to file them, and that we also have a system for following up with them when they fail to file them on time, but also prompt them to do it before it's due, and that they know what the consequences will be if they fail to file. And so we are much, much more compliant in our financial disclosure forms. And I even went a step further, and now it's not just me that's accountable in my financial disclosure. Uniquely, elected officials also have to disclose certain things about their spouse's income as well. My wife is an artist, for example. Now, what if the top dogs at somebody who was trying to do business with the city was paying my wife tens of thousands of dollars for art, right? There might be a conflict of interest there, right? And so I have to disclose things about her work as well. So we've improved a lot of things about public trust and public accountability. And I led on all of those things. I led on three different ethics bills in my first term, plus the creation of the Inspector General.
How popular or unpopular did it make you in your own circle?
I don't know. It's not a popularity context for me, so I don't pay any attention to it.
I've never met you before 3 days ago.
Yeah.
I know of you. You said you were ducking me. I don't know if he's kidding or not. But for me, the whole accountability part of you being an elected before I thought of being an elected, long after I thought of not being an elected, and through all of this process, that you're the perfect guy to come on the show to talk about what was wrong to make it right. I love that you're here now in saying the city, in your time here, you can literally say this place has gotten better. And so Brandon can sit here and say that. Bill Henry's going to come over here and in a little while and say that, because I really believe that to be true. But the numbers, despite what Schittler says, are where we are, and all of you should stand proud. All the things you just said to me would resonate to somebody that's never heard any of it. Say, well, maybe guys like him, rabble rousers, and guys that are going to come in and not worry about pissing off somebody that's going to jail, you know, literally. And there was a perception that it was just rampantly out of control in regard to ethics, in regard to money, in regard to, you know, lots of names that are still out in the news of people getting released and paroled and all of this stuff. First things first, we have people on the up and up now, and we've had the same mayor through two terms, and we've had stability, right? I mean, the things that were missing when you came into this 12 years ago, there is some stability here now that is its own benefit, right?
Yeah, not to mention a massive decrease in homicides and violent crime in the city.
Why is that? Explain to folks why that is.
Because the gun violence reduction strategy that Mayor Scott has put forth is working, plain and simple.
He sat and told me what he was going to do. And I talked to a lot of smart people around that time because I was thinking of running. So I'm doing a radio show trying to find the smartest people I can about all of the thoughts of how we don't have Freddie Gray again, how we don't have mayors going to jail again, like none of that. And they said to me, we're going to take young black men who are very violent, who don't have parents, and we're going to talk to them. We're just going to talk to them.
Yeah, that's right.
And
tough on crime has absolutely no history of working here or anywhere else. Tough on crime is a myth. Like, smart on crime and intelligent about how we treat and work with, not work against, human beings as human beings actually works here and everywhere else. And that's what we've begun to do as a city, and it is paying out dividends.
When you first heard of the strategy and Mayor Scott's plan, you sound like you were probably in on it from the beginning. Like, hey, what we're doing is not... You didn't like the police commissioner. It's a lot of things you didn't like. You didn't like transportation. There's a lot of things that you stood out, pissed off about.
My whole job is to be unhappy with things and try to put forth the things that I think will make me less unhappy.
Right? Okay, fair enough. Okay. Right?
That's half my job. The other half of my job is to hear from other people about what they're unhappy with and try to fix their problems. 95% of my problem is just my job is just hearing, where somebody's got an issue and trying to solve it on a case-by-case basis. And then when I see those cases amass over time, to go, what's the underlying cause here? What can we change as a system, as a policy, as a law that will stop this from continuing to happen? And not just stop it, but like bring about the positive alternative to it.
If your phone's ringing about the same thing over and over again. Right?
Yeah, and sometimes, and for a lot of people, it's not a linear connection, or it's not intuitive necessarily that the end and the means are connected. And we're at a point now where I've been kind of at some of the same things for long enough that the dots are getting connected for more and more people. And so
you start to sound smarter when it works too.
We're in a
when
place
you can point at it and say this was a good idea.
Or when other people start going, you know what we should do? And somebody goes, that's the thing that Dorsey's been talking about for the last, 3 years. And that's where we are right now with respect to our housing crisis and our housing affordability crisis and what we can and should and need to be doing to improve our housing outcomes and housing production in the city. And we're at a place now where, part of why I feel so positive on the city right now is that we're basically all rowing in the same direction. Me, as the Land Use and Transportation Committee Chair, and as a close ally to City Council President Zeke Cohen, and a close ally to Mayor Scott, we're all working in the same direction to advance policies that will help us to produce more housing to fulfill an unmet need that's been chronically unmet for a very, very long time, not just in Baltimore City, but in the state. You've heard Governor Moore talking about this. And at the national level, you hear people like Elizabeth Warren talking about the millions of housing units that we are short as a nation, and where everybody understands that the crux of the problem lies at every individual local jurisdictional level throughout the country. That we all adopted really bad land use zoning laws a century or half a century or more ago.
Or redlining in our case.
Well, that's right. We pioneered it. And the Supreme Court invalidating laws like Baltimore's prompted federal leadership, Calvin Coolidge, Woodrow Wilson, a century ago, to teach local jurisdictions how to write laws that would produce the same discriminatory, segregative outcome by constitutionally acceptable means, using economic tools to separate people, when the Supreme Court said you can't use the color of a person's skin to explicitly segregate them by law.
Right.
And so today we're 100 years steeped in those same laws, and they don't look really any different now than they did 100 years ago. And they are the reason why we have segregated neighborhoods, not just by race, but also by class, and that our housing stock is dramatically mismatched for our supply, between our supply and demand. It's why we have far fewer housing units than what we need as a city, than we have a demand for as a city, and why we're unable to produce the number and the type of dwelling units and in the neighborhoods where people want to live.
Well, by the way, Ryan Dorsey's here, a third district councilman here in Baltimore City. We are in his district. We're here at Coco's Pub celebrating 27 years for me, 40 years for Marcel and her mom. And it's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery, your friends at GBMC, as well as I'm going to be eating some coconut shrimp here, courtesy of our friends at Curio Wellness, because it's our 27th anniversary, and they sponsor all of our anniversaries around here. I had Zeke on 2 weeks ago. I had Odette on. I had Mark Conway on. Felicia was going to come today but couldn't make it. I talked to Brandon a couple of times last couple weeks. I haven't had him on the show. And I had Zach on as well. All of you have spoken of housing. Like, and obviously, Odette, it's her thing, right? So here's where I get at it and say we're so flighty in Baltimore City for people leaving, and the electorate gets smaller and smaller, and tax base gets smaller and smaller. And yet I saw a report this week that we're like the third most young people getting jobs and affordability to some degree to be able to move in, maybe with roommates in Federal Hill like we used to do in the day. But the housing issue, we used to have a lot more residents in this city. Deteriorating housing, obviously lead, paint, asbestos, all those things, unlivable housing, dwellings that need to be not just rethought but raised. And all. Your district and what you've seen for a dozen years here, you have more people, less housing. And when you say we don't have enough housing, why is that? Because the city's always been the same, and at one point we had twice as many people around here.
If you look at not just the most recent census but even the one before that, you can see that we have a clear trajectory where even though we are losing total number of residents, we are actually gaining in number of households. And if you look here and in the metropolitan area and across the country, what has happened is that average household size has shrunk from 3.5 people to 2.5 people. When you're talking about little numbers like that, a difference of one person makes a huge difference.
Which is between 400,000 and 600,000.
That's right.
Literally, look at it like that.
And right? So what we have are fewer people trying to occupy more dwellings. And yet we have only retained, for the most part, the same large dwellings that were accommodating boomer families with 6 and 8 and 10
kids. These big,
kids.
Beautiful homes in this neighborhood.
That's right.
Up in Berkshire. Yep,
right.
Yep.
And
Beverly
so we've got two adults or three, you know, two adults and a baby occupying a 3-bedroom house that once housed 10 people in it and could clearly adequately house that number of people still today. And we prohibit that too large a house from ever becoming even two apartments. Right? So you... And you and your partner and your 8 kids can all live in this house, and it's perfectly acceptable for there to be 10 people living in that house. And each of you can own 2 cars and park those 20 cars up and down the street anywhere you want. But it's a bridge too far to say, let's put up some walls and install a new kitchen and bathroom
and make it part a duplex.
Of it and make it into two units. And Nestor and Ryan each live in this as 2 apartments. The 2 of us are too much, but the 10 that are the family that can live there are not. And this is, you know, totally illogical, and we don't make that same rule in row home neighborhoods. We only make that rule for detached home neighborhoods because by design, they were conceived through zoning as a place of exclusivity where you can't live here if you are somebody who can only afford an apartment. You can't live here unless you have the money for the down payment, the income level, the credit to be able to get the loan, And the car payment on top of that, because we've spread it out so much that it's you can't practically live in much of these neighborhoods unless you also drive a car and are dependent on that just to come and go from your house anytime you want to go anywhere.
Transportation. I think that's when I think of you from the outside. I think of transportation. I think of you as the bike guy. And
a lot of people do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you stood on that, right?
So Fox Baltimore has gone to great lengths to portray me as a person who only cares about bikes.
Okay. So I don't watch Fox News, but I did think it's your signature issue. You know what I mean? People think my signature issue was fighting with Peter Angelos, but that's not all I did. or not all I'm capable of doing. But the transportation thing and biking, and I'll just say this to you. I don't bike. I have biked in places. I don't like the way people drive. I would not feel safe on a motorcycle based on how unsafe I feel sometimes on 695 here. That being said, been to Amsterdam. I am a world traveler.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been on 5 continents. I've been in big cities. I've been in farms. I've been in mountains. I've been in islands. I get the bike thing. I appreciate the Asian part of it. I appreciate the Netherlands part of it. My thought was, when are people going to adopt it here? It's a great idea, in theory, until nobody rides bikes or doesn't feel safe on a bike or wherever it was. Or the bike lanes get so dirty with schmutz and trash that you couldn't ride through it if you wanted to. Now, I will say this. I drove down Argon Lane about 2 years ago cursing you, saying, Dorsey won't even come on my show and there's trash here and he built these things and who the hell would use this? And now today, I didn't do this on purpose because I usually take Cold Spring to Moravia. I was going to go over to Woodley's in your district, right? Woodley Bakery?
Woodley Bakery is directly across the street from the northeast corner of my district.
All right. Well, you can still walk over there and get chocolate chip cookies.
Cause the best donut.
Best cookies. Chocolate chip cookies, my jam over there. I'll go to Fenwick for the peach cake next week, too.
But, no kidding.
So for me, the notion that bikes are a great thing, that they could catch on, that people should be doing it, that it's healthy, that it's all of that. But I took Argon down here, and it was cleaner from the college through that I can literally look at you and say, you could ride your bike through there today. 2 years ago, it wasn't good. The glass, just using the bike lane as a dumping spot doesn't help bikers, and it doesn't help your cause to create the bike lanes. But I know what you were trying to do, which was open this up, that you wouldn't need a car, you'd be healthy, you could get where you want to go. And for people who don't have the money, that we all know the transportation system with busing, I've been up and down that river a million times, that I live in Lauraville and I work in Towson. How the hell do I get there if I don't have a car? Because it's tough. I grew up in a house without a car. I took buses everywhere in my childhood.
Yep.
So the first 15 years of my life, I had a bus pass in the city, in the county, everywhere. I know that that's not a great way to do this. I take the light rail to the airport a couple times a year. It's fine. I live in Towson. But the bike thing, give me the whole soup to nuts, fight back on the Fox Baltimore thing, and tell me where your inspiration and perspiration came for transportation.
A third of the households in the city of Baltimore don't own a car. And if you look at the multi-adult households that have only one car, this is all based on census data, what it comes down to is when you combine those multi-adult households with only one car and the households that have no cars, 50% of the adults in Baltimore City can't walk out their front door and get into a car and go where they want to go right now. And
now, that's hard for some people in their car, cushy little car right now, driving around in their Lexus or the BMW or their Toyota or their late model Chevy, and they're listening to me on the Beltway right now. You don't have a car, you know.
Yeah, and so
everybody I knew growing up has a car. I go to Manhattan all the time. Nobody has. It's not.
Sure.
I live downtown Baltimore. There were weeks we didn't move our car.
Yeah, and there's massive economic disparities that follow that delineation of car ownership or non-ownership.
What kind of job can I get?
And transportation is the number one barrier. It's the deal maker or breaker in terms of being able to find a job, too. I mean, it's the number one barrier to employment.
If you get a job at Trade Point Atlantic right now from here, probably 8 miles away, because I'm in a How would you get there?
90 minutes of public transportation each way.
And nobody understands. I understand that because I've talked to five mayors in a row, and I lived in the city for 20 years.
Yeah.
I understand that. I understand that. But, like, people don't really understand that, that if Marcella wants to hire someone here at Coco's, hiring a nice kid from 5 miles away on the wrong side of the tracks, they have no way to get to work, literally.
What people
right?
also don't understand is how we got here. And that is at the end of World War II. This is the end of World War II is precisely when the city started losing population. White flight and the GI Bill started promoting white people moving out of Baltimore City. And they were moving there into newly sprawling suburbs, and they were moving there with their cars, and they were still working in Baltimore City and retaining friendships, relationships, and influence, so that even though they were abandoning our tax base, they were still wielding influence over city decision making. And
they made their money in Baltimore.
That's
they made
right.
their living, right?
And so as it became an imperative for them to drive their car as fast as possible from their home in Baltimore County into downtown Baltimore, they persuaded Baltimore City leadership to prioritize their interest of cars over the interest of public transit. And this meant
the road to nowhere.
Well, this meant
specifically
flooding the streets with cars that were then impeding the very high-functioning streetcar operation in the city, high frequency and very high consistency to streetcar operations, especially where left-turning cars were stopping on the center-running streetcar tracks and obstructing those streetcars from progressing down the road because they were stuck behind a car that was waiting for traffic so that the car could turn left.
So one car right. stopping 200 people.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Oh, yeah, okay.
And then and because the streetcars...
This is the 60s you're talking about, 50s and 60s, right?
The okay. 1950s, late 40s, mm-hmm. yeah,
okay.
because the streetcar system was systematically dismantled...
Before the Beltway came
from
and all...
From 47 okay. to 63.
Right.
And so the cars were what made it impossible for us to continue to reliably run streetcar operation, public transportation. And so...
I didn't know that.
That
I
is mean, exactly...
I'm East Baltimore. My dad would take the 23 streetcar, you know, I mean, Eastern Avenue, Highlandtown, and all that. In Highlandtown, the tracks were always still there.
Yeah.
You know, you could still see them in a couple of places maybe around town, but you would see the tracks, and I'm like... Well, what made that a bad idea? Cars. Cars made
yeah.
it a bad idea.
Cars made it a bad idea. Okay. Cars made it a non-functional system. And that was a decision to prioritize one set of transportation needs or desires over another. And that meant that if you wanted a high quality of life, you had to already be able to buy into the middle class at the cost of a car note. That was the cost of entry into the middle class. And if you didn't have that from the outset, you were stuck economically. And
that's car insurance, gas.
That's right.
Right.
On average today in Maryland, it costs somewhere between $9,000 and $10,000 per year to own a vehicle. That's by far the most expensive means of getting around. And so we're leaving people behind who can't already afford that. And for the people who can just barely afford it, it's coming at a cost to rob Peter to pay Paul.
Or 25% of their income.
That's right. That's right. It's a substantial portion.
Before housing, before food.
Right, yeah. That's right. And so at a very fundamental level, creating safe and adequate and interconnected bicycling facilities is about creating any viable alternative at all for that 50% of the population who can't walk out of their door right now.
Can I play old guy on the radio, Rye?
Sure, old man.
Can I be the old man here? Those damn lime machines, they come out in front of me. I'm going to kill somebody out there. Is that pretty good? That's my Dundalk coming out. You like that?
Drive slower. Drive slower. Be
more careful. Those lime things are cray-cray. And I'm just saying because, like, if I hit somebody,
Are you talking about flex posts, like the poles, or are you talking?
No, I'm talking about the little Johnsons, the scooter rooters.
Scooter. Yeah.
Yeah,
but,
I mean.
But you know how few scooter-related crashes there are, or bicycle-related crashes, or even dirt bike-related crashes there are, compared to car-on-car or car careening off-road?
Well, there's more cars.
Yeah, but even proportionally.
Listen, I'm not against your bike thing. I'm not even against the scooter rooters. I'm for safety, and we should give that more. Your transportation, give that more tickets in the city.
We wouldn't need. That's right. We wouldn't need bike facilities if drivers were just more considerate and safe in the
first
place.
I would be for a camera between Bel Air Road and Hartford, Hartford and Joppa, Joppa and... I, the way I'm seeing people drive after the last 10 years, it's all different level of craziness. So the bike lane thing that happened here, at what expense, I think the step, we haven't mentioned Stephanie's name. Stephanie's the bike lane lady in a lot of people's mind.
No, it was Sheila.
Go ahead, Sheila, go ahead.
Sheila put
But it was during Stephanie's period.
Sheila
that it
put forth the
off.
First serious bicycle facility plan in the city. Or actually, Schaefer did.
Well, now we're going back 40 years, not 20 years.
Yeah, there was a bike plan dating all the way back to Schaefer, never implemented. Sheila was the first to start the work of like creating bicycle facilities in the city. Stephanie created the Mayor's Bicycle Advisory Commission, and it's just been a slog to try to get anything done year after year after
year. Can you prove that more people are using it? And are I see you from Fox News standing on it and saying it's your issue. I would love, dude, I would love 10 years from now to see us visibly look more like Amsterdam.
You've been to Amsterdam, right?
I have.
All right. You're familiar. And so all of this talk about like people are like, they get crazed.
Don't
over
get stoned on a bike. Not that I've done that in Amsterdam or anything, but.
You familiar with this term? You ever heard the term bike lash?
I think it's the first time I've ever admitted that on the air, but it's fine. You ever heard your sponsor? It's fine.
You ever heard the word bike lash? This is what happens when you install bike lanes anywhere. There's backlash over the bike lanes. Bike lash, right?
Where else have they done it where it's been like gotten away with it? Austin, Texas, or
Amsterdam.
Nah, okay. They did that a million years ago, right?
That's right.
They had to get the cars out of there because the city's sinking and there's nowhere to put the cars. There is no parking in Amsterdam.
Just envision the worst traffic jam you've ever been in Baltimore City. It was even worse in Amsterdam, everywhere, all the time in the 1970s. And they went, you know what doesn't work? This. We need an alternative to this. And so they started building bicycle facilities, and they committed to it, and the culture changed because of it. And now it is this thing that nobody who's ever even thought about it knows go, Amsterdam, that's a place where people bike. It's just so readily identifiable. It's because they started doing what Baltimore is doing. 40
well,
plus
they really
ago.
Had no choice. I mean, as I see it,
do we?
Amsterdam, the do whole we? City looks like the pier at Fells Point or downtown in Annapolis, where it's just bricky and narrow and built three centuries ago. And you feel penalized if you had a car there. I wouldn't know what the hell to do with a car in downtown Amsterdam. You know, like literally.
And we can be the same.
But will we? You know, I mean, if I love the ideology.
If we maintain our commitment to becoming a healthier, more equitable, livable city, yes, over time. But it takes time. And every
I think we
place
should take the first $1 billion the city has and buy 10 million bikes and give them to everybody. And if everybody had a bike, they would use it, I think, I guess.
Sure. Well, look, on the far one end of the spectrum, you got the 10% of people who they're going to bike everywhere all the time. You can't get them in a car. It's the only way they want to get around. On the other end of the spectrum, you got 10% that are like, there's nothing you could do to possibly get me on a bike ever. In between, you got 80% of the population that's interested but concerned. You got to make it safe for people. You also have to make it working. It can't just be a safe bike lane that goes from point A to point B and doesn't connect to any other bike lane. You got to build safe and interconnected bicycle facilities so that people
can
get...
Well, if you're driving on a freeway, the freeway doesn't stop and there's no road anymore, right?
Right.
I mean, like, you can't
right.
have that with a
That's
bike
right.
path. Right.
Yeah. Well, we think that...
Well, we built a road to nowhere. So.
We think that it's a failure if we build a bike lane from one point to another and nobody uses it without going, but wait a minute, where would the bicyclists be coming from? Where would they be going? Only where this one bike lane goes, why doesn't it connect to any other bike lanes? We have to build out a complete network in order for it to be functional and usable.
Well, look, if you ever can get Paring Parkway paved, maybe we just shut it down to cars and just let it be a bike lane. I mean, to me, if Lombard was a bike lane and Pratt was a two-way car thing, and I could just get where there's nothing but bikes, like Amsterdam,
yeah,
like... I would feel safe, and I'm almost 60, but I don't, Every time I've been on a bike as an adult, it hurts my hiney. I don't like bikes. That's why I do yoga. And I'm not a what do they call that cycling thing that they do in the classes that you don't
spin class?
Yeah, the road to nowhere there. I ain't doing all that. But I don't love bikes. But the biggest thing for me with a bike is just feeling like somebody's going to kill me in a car. That's my biggest concern.
Cars are deadly.
I know this.
Yeah.
Ryan Dorsey.
Yes, sir.
Transportation, housing, 3rd District, councilman, citizen. You're not a rock star anymore, though. You're not in a band anymore? You're
no.
Done?
I do play my electric bass these days.
You play bass?
I play scales, and I play arpeggios. That's it.
Just like shooting free throws or like...
That's right.
Like just putt-putt instead of real golf.
Why wouldn't I? Yeah.
I like it. So, for your district, what's important here? We talked about city issues. What are the things you fight every day? The little bridge over here in Montebello was something getting done, right? That was
a big deal. I mean, it needed to be replaced, but the plan was for it to be replaced like a highway-like bridge that only served the purpose of moving as many cars as fast as possible. And that was just an outdated mid-20th century, 1950s kind of ideal. And I made sure that it was better and more than that. And it's, really thoroughly enjoyed by a lot of different people for a lot of different ways of getting around now.
Are you heartened when you see people on bikes riding around in these lanes? I mean, I step across them when I see them. And one thing I'll say is I notice them because they've changed the parking. They've changed how it is. I can't say that I see bikes flying everywhere through there, but I want to. I know they're there. I don't want some jack wagon to come along 15 years from now and throw it out, right? I mean, now that they're here to stay, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and now it's like, all right, let's use them, get a job, have transportation, be healthier. All of those things that we set for, save money.
The housing is the biggest issue at this point, right? Like I said before, the housing and the transportation, they go hand in glove. You can't get a bunch of people riding buses if you've created a system where everything's so spread out, like suburbs, where you need to use a car to get where you're going. So you have to build in a concentration of bus ridership along where the buses run in order to justify increased bus service and to make it possible for that reliability to serve more people. Same thing with bicycle facilities. You make the bike lanes go where people need to come from and where they need to go to. That's why we have them and prioritize putting them along main streets like Harford Road so that businesses don't run on how many cars you can park. Businesses run on how many people, no matter how they get there, can come in and out and spend their dollars. And when you can get people there by more than one means, more than just driving.
Accessibility.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
And so, but at the same time, you need population density around those commercial corridors as well in order for them to have a mix of an adequate number of customers who come from a block away, two blocks away, and also people who come from a half a mile or a mile or on the other side of the city. And we really severely lack that. Harford Road here has the lowest population density of any of the commercial corridors in the city. And
maybe that's what I came up with the wrong word with Zach last week, because I said you have more people in your zone. No, we're zoned by people as we vote, but I said you have density. I mean, his goes up. Yours has big houses and wide spaces.
That's right.
Moravia, Walther, all of this area over here, right? So built
that's
a
right.
lot. It looks different than this. It doesn't look row housey.
That's right.
Okay.
And so that lower density makes it impossible for us to support more businesses than what we already have here existing on Harford Road.
Because you don't have enough humans.
We don't have enough humans. And we've known this for a very long time and done nothing about it. And so that's why I've put forth this bill to create this Harford Road Overlay District to allow higher density housing within the first block off of Harford Road. We're not saying transform drastically the whole neighborhood, and we don't even expect that first block to transform drastically. We just want to stop prohibiting the possibility of higher density housing in that area where it's most walkable to the commercial corridor to that bus line.
In cities with subways, D.C. would be a great example, but even New York would be the greatest example. And I often think of whatever courage it took to have be a city council person in the 1890s or whenever it was in New York City and say, we're going to build holes underneath the city and we're going to burrow out with trains that are going to run through. Like, just Baltimore never entertained that concept. Lots of cities in America never entertained that concept. Certainly west of here, everything's freeways and freedom and Texas and, you know, all of that. Yeah. And then you go to Europe and see how people get around and how they live, and the quality of life isn't spent doing this 45 minutes driving from Arlington to, you know, Dallas in the triplex at $4 a gallon.
Yeah, even when other East Coast cities, I mean, D.C., were opting into federal assistance to build subway systems, Baltimore opted out. We had basically said, we've already...
We're too racist for that, yeah.
We've already thrown in the towel on our streetcar system. We're totally bought into cars as a way of life. We don't want the billions of federal assistance in order to build out a functional mass transit
system. Yeah, I had Larry Hogan on the show talking about killing the red line. I ran on that. Okay, well, that's why I didn't vote for you. So, so for me, this notion of having humans crowded toward Harford Road, or not crowded, but just more density,
it's not
right?
Crowded.
Like, but the notion that that's what a subway stop would look like, that's what East Point Mall looked like when I was a kid, being a mall rat, was like, there's a mall. You put people around it. You put transportation there, and they work at the point. They work at GM. They work downtown. They can get there. There's the Beltway. They can get there that way. So it becomes a spoken hub, right? I mean, literally where people want to work. It helps Zeke's. It helps Coco's. It helps all of these businesses, and people would want to walk to their Cheers or to whatever their service, their yoga
studio,
their market.
It doesn't just help these businesses. Right? It makes it possible for there to be more of these businesses. You know, right now, you could have maybe one, like, handmade goods store, you know, for, like, boutique items somewhere along the Harford Road corridor. But if you opened a second one, they would cannibalize each other and both would fail.
Just not enough customers.
Right. And so creating the possibility of more people living in these neighborhoods where people want to live, right? These are high market value areas. People really want to live here. But we have laws that prohibit the neighborhood from expanding its housing opportunity. And so we can change that, but we have to change zoning laws. And that's what I've made my number one priority.
See, I love this. Almost like a Mork and Mindy episode with Ryan Dorsey. What have we learned here today? We've learned that we have outdated, antiquated laws that were set up mainly by racists to make things that are very functional dysfunctional. So is that good? Was that good?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, the last thing you just said really resonated with me in regard to getting people to where the buses would be, where the where the bike lanes, where all of that, so that they can have jobs and have better lives and be closer to good schools and all that good stuff.
That's right.
Keep up the good work, man. It's fun. Fun hour. It went by so quick that I've blown into Bill Henry's time. So the good controller, I saw him a minute ago. I think he's at, yeah. See, I got my reading glasses on. I could barely, I'm like, Bill, is that you? And you winked at him, and I'm like, yeah, it's Bill Henry. Tell me where they can find more information from you if they live in your district and they're mad at you or they're happy with you or they saw you on Fox News and want to be nice to you. How do they find you?
Email me, ryan.dorsey@baltimorecity.gov. We've got a weekly newsletter that we put out about events and grants and other opportunities coming up, city programs and things like that. And I write my own, like, 4 or 5 paragraph, most people would say too long, message every single Friday. I write about whatever I'm up to and whatever I think
that's
is
when
important.
You really piss people off sometimes, right? That's the fun one.
Look, the easiest way to get in politics is to do nothing and have no opinions on anything. You can't piss anybody off. I actually came to get things done, and in particular the difficult things that nobody else was trying to do because they're too difficult, but they're equally or more important.
Well, a dozen years in, you're getting stuff done, man. We finally sat down and you got a track record, a lot of answers for people. So my pleasure, really. Thank you.
Thanks, Nestor.
And also classmate of the guy that named me Nasty Nestor 40 years ago. We're out here at Coco's, and you're about to go eat some delicious
food. I
got to
eat, man. I got to be down at City Hall in 15 minutes.
Get the cream of crab soup, get the coconut shrimp, get yourself a Greek salad. It's money. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. The Lucky Sevens doublers are here. I'll be giving these away later on the week. You can drop the mic. Just boom, throw it down. Bill Henry's going to be here. Rasig's going to be here with his wife. And I think Marcel's going to come by. We're going to celebrate 40 years of Cuckoo's Pub at Coco's Pub. We're in Lauraville. Stay with us.